I want to thank whoever chose the hymns today for selecting God of Grace and God of Glory. It is one of my favorite hymns. I don't know if you know the background of it. It was written by Harry Emerson Fosdick, who was an American Baptist serving in the First Presbyterian Church of New York years and years ago. I don't know how that happened, but he was a dynamic speaker, and he was very creative. He had the idea that maybe doctrines and dogmas aren't meant to hem people in, but to set them free to think and be creative. So he began questioning the doctrine of the Trinity a little bit. As a doctrine, he said it was a love poem. Well, the church had no problem with this, but the presbytery did. And therein began a long crusade by these very fundamentalist types who get him out of the church, went all the way to the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church, which then formally removed him from office. And so he left First Presbyterian. And John D. Rockefeller decided this was terrible because the man had a lot to say, so he underwrote the building of the Riverside Church in New York. So the obstinacy of the Presbyterians actually can lead to good. Some of you have noted the title of my remarks today. Okay, I admit it. Charlton Heston led me to believe in God. And what I want to talk about today, since we're in the grip of a national controversy, I don't want to talk about that. However, I will say it makes me long for the days when the biggest news item was Janet Jackson and her weapons of mass distraction. That was just a few weeks ago. But I won't talk anymore about that. I want to talk about where we get a lot of our ideas about faith, about religion, about who we are. And I want you to think about your childhood, things that you were told growing up. Maybe Santa Claus, maybe the Easter Bunny, maybe about what was good or bad or what you'd get in trouble with or about. One of the enduring things that I remember is that someone showed me, when I was a youngster, an object very much like this. Have you ever seen anything like this before? Now, these grow in Kansas, I was told. They're called jackalopes. You remember these? You've seen these?
West Yellowstone.
That's right. And I believed it, along with snipes. Have you ever gone snipe hunting? Snipe hunting, you've been gone those before? And you know, there's a point in your childhood that you believe anything. And then finally one day you grow up and you become a cynic. You become an adult. And that's a tragedy. What I wonder when I look at this is what happens to the eyes when the horns go right down there, but you're not supposed to look that carefully. So I believe this about this critter for, I think, 20 years until somebody told me it ain't so. And those moments when you're told something you believe in so strongly ain't so, those can be debilitating, sad times, or they can be tremendously liberating. Well, one of the other things that I remember growing up was seeing the Ten Commandments for the first time. Cecil B. DeMille's great epic. And I remember the idea that God was involved with history and was so concerned about the ancient Israelite people that he sent Moses, especially a man strapping and young with that stentorian voice that Charlton Heston had. And this had an early shaping, formative function in my faith. And I believe that God was intricately involved in shaping people's destiny like this. And I was looking out for signs and glimmers that God was so involved. My upbringing was in Coronado, California. Very conservative area, populated by a lot of Navy admirals and enlisted men and officers. Newsweek called it years ago Idiot's Island. And I don't know if there's a cause and effect to that, but... And so I was caught up in this patriotic fervor. I remember seeing Barry Goldwater in 1964 And I was all for Goldwater because there was something about Goldwater that was making people nervous, and I love that. I think some of that stuck with me. I think that, especially as a minister, if you're not making somebody nervous, something's wrong. You should afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted, I thought. Well, Goldwater certainly did that. And by the way, just for a little historical note, you may recall that election, and it seemed like Barry Goldwater and Lyndon Johnson had nothing in common. Not true. Do you know they were both passionately involved and believed in something together? You'd never know it from that election. What was that thing? The what? Jackalopes. They hunted them in Texas and Arizona. No, they were passionate defenders of Planned Parenthood. They believed in choice. You'd never know that, would you? Barry Goldwater was a staunch conservative, and part of his conservatism was keep the government out of people's personal choices. He and his wife helped found the Planned Parenthood Clinic in Phoenix in the early 50s. Anyway, growing up in Coronado, it took me years to understand that the world didn't exactly exist the way I thought it did. And I had to grow. I spent a year studying at the University of Copenhagen. And that was the denouement, shall we say, of my development, to see that the world was totally different from what I had understood it to be. I finally realized that jackalope did not exist. Everything that I learned in kindergarten was not true, contrary to the minister who wrote the book. Everything I learned in Sunday school wasn't true. I remember in Sunday school I was told the story of Christmas, and you've heard this. The story of Mary and Joseph and the babe in the manger and the wise men and the shepherds all gathering there. And then, of course, I learned later on that it ain't so. Did you know that? There is nowhere in the Bible where you have Mary and Joseph and shepherds and wise men and a manger. Did you know that? Now, if I've done nothing else today, I have ruined your concept of Christmas. Where did we get that image? Hallmark cards. Artists. They have taken the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke and just nicely put them together in a warm, fuzzy blend that just oozes sentimentality, thereby ruining Luke's and Matthew's point, which has some difference. You have wise men visiting Jesus and Mary and Joseph in the Gospel of Matthew where? See, if you were Presbyterians and make the big deal about the Bible that you do, I would really be sticking it to you now. But because you're Unitarians, well, the wise men, and there are no shepherds there, mainly because their olfactory senses would have been offended by shepherds, visit Mary, Joseph, and the babe in a house. The Gospel of Matthew is addressed to middle-class folks. They have a house. Did you know that? I know I'm ruining this for you. In Luke, addressed to the dispossessed and the marginalized, we have the shepherds, but no wise men. The angels and the news go to the poor, and they run to find Mary and Joseph, and where are they to be found? In a stable. No place to put their head. No place to call home. They are dispossessed. Two distinct stories, but in your childhood, and I learned this in Sunday school, we just put them together. Oh, isn't that nice? Well, one more jackalope put to rest. I want to recommend a book for you for your summer reading. Maybe you've read it already. I think it's John Irving's best book, A Prayer for Owen Meany. How many of you have read this? Isn't that great? I think the guy was on a roll when he wrote this. And I just, anything he's written that's quite come up to the irony and the theology and the humor. And the story is so improbable. It seems eccentric, far-fetched, like a jackalope. A young boy has a friend, the young boy's friend, Owen Meany, The narrator is Johnny Wheelwright. He narrates the story, but it's about Owen Meany. Owen Meany is a little kid, so little that they pass him around in Sunday school. They hold him up and pass him around. He's really little. He never, as he grows up to adulthood, doesn't get very tall. And Owen Meany has this high, ruined voice. Somehow, because his father runs a granite quarry, the dust or something has ruined his voice. So he has this high-pitched voice, and whenever he tries to talk, it sounds like a squeal. And Owen Meany and Johnny Wheelwright are 8 or 9 years old, and they're in a little league game. And Owen Meany, who never pitches unless he wants to get on base, a base on balls, because he's so short, the pitcher can't get the strike zone, so they never let him at bat until unless they want a base on balls. So this time, Owen and Johnny's team is losing so badly, the coach tells Owen to swing away. What difference does it make? And so little Owen Meany hits the ball, and it's a foul ball, but this ball has a tragic trajectory. And it goes and hits Johnny Wheelwright's mother and kills her. How is that the way to start a book? And you find out that Owen Meany is so devastated by this that he is forced to believe that somehow he is an instrument of God. And in the book, everything he says is in capital letters, reminding you of someone else. A prayer for Owen Meany. Now, the reason I mention this book is that my idea of God and Owen Meany's have some affinity. I think it's a kind of a Presbyterian book, actually, in many respects. The idea of predestination and so on. Owen Meany tries to discover what he is here for, especially since the beginning of his life has such terrible consequences. And so he has to wrestle with that. He has to make sense of it. And so he comes to the ironic conclusion that he must be used by God to achieve some great purpose of mythic proportions. Maybe some good came out of that tragedy. Well, the story unfolds in some weird ways. This has the funniest, speaking of Christmas, the funniest telling of a Christmas pageant with kids in a church you will ever read. It is really funny. I'd recommend it. Now, another book that talks about someone who had an early idea of the way they should live their life as a life of faith was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. How many of you are familiar with Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Well, he would probably have led a very quiet, unassuming, and anonymous life. He was born in 1908. He studied to be a German Lutheran pastor. He was a son of a renowned psychiatrist in Berlin. His neighbor was Adolf Harnack, one of the great philosophers in the early part of the 20th century. And he had a classical German education. He got his doctorate. He would have been comfortable in a Lutheran pulpit and never been heard from again. Except there was a foul ball. And that foul ball was Adolf Hitler. And Bonhoeffer, who had definite ideas, those of you who are German or know German theology, know that Germans respect authority. German Christians respected authority. One of the orders of creation, as Martin Luther taught, was the order of the state, the order of the church, nature, God. The church and the state existed side by side, but neither had much to do with the other. The church never addressed the state, and under no circumstances would the church seek to influence the state, let alone overthrow the head of state. Never, no way, nada, nine, zip. But Bonhoeffer internalized, embodied the struggle to be true to the will of God and the righteousness of God, and he could not abide by the anti-Semitism and the persecution and the totalitarianism of the Hitler regime. And he couldn't quite get it together until he visited New York City and went to Union Seminary and studied there for several months. He made friends with black Americans who took him down to the South, where Bonhoeffer viewed the evils of segregation. And this had an effect like a foul ball. that rocked his world and cast him into a new place where he had to make sense of life using new ingredients, new categories. And he went back to Germany and left the prevailing German Lutheran Church and became involved in what was called the Confessing Church, which sought to train pastors and lead congregations in understanding what they must do to sabotage the Hitler regime in quiet ways. Finally, Bonhoeffer decided he had to be actively engaged in ending the Hitler regime, putting a piece of wood in the spoke of the wheel, as he called it. And he, along with others, engaged to assassinate Adolf Hitler. Something that could not be comprehended in any way with his traditional German Lutheran theology. For this, the plot, there are actually two or three plots against Hitler's life, as you may know. None of them seemed to work out. And this forced Bonhoeffer to wonder, how could God thwart these efforts that would have led to an end of World War II and saved millions of lives? He couldn't understand it. And that projected him, much like Owen Meany in the novel, to new understandings, new struggles to figure out his faith. To make a long story short, Bonhoeffer was arrested in 1943. In 1944, the SS discovered the full nature of his complicity in this assassination attempt, and he was executed on the personal orders of Hitler a month before liberation for the end of World War II. And Bonhoeffer is studied now in seminaries and by others because while he was in prison, one of his key writings, he had a book on ethics, one called The Cost of Discipleship, which are difficult to read, but his best book, Letters and Papers from Prison, show a man who is reaching for new language and new understanding of God. He comes up with some interesting phrases, and we don't know what he really meant by it because he died. He talks about the fact now that we have to get away from believing in a God who controls every event. We have to stop praying to a God that is, in the Latin, the Deus ex machina, the God of the machine, who fixes things, who drops out of heaven to answer our little prayers, whom we baptize as being for this side or for that side. Because Bonhoeffer realized that this God no longer will do. This God is a God for infancy and adolescence, but not for mature, grown-up adults. And so he said, we must stand before God without God. He called for a religionless Christianity. We don't know what he meant by that. Now, this must have been a terrible thing for Bonhoeffer to write because he was shaped and formed in the liturgy and the worship and the ritual of his Lutheran church. And he realized in some terrible ways that much of this liturgy and ritual was keeping people infantile and small. So he had an experience of seeing life in new mythic proportions. The book that I recommended is a fictionalized life of Bonhoeffer. That is, it uses the key ingredients of his life, but takes a lot of liberties in some of the narratives and some of his personal relationships, combines certain events and people that he knew. It's called Saints and Villains, and it's written by Denise Giardina, and I would highly recommend this for your summer reading, because as you interact with Bonhoeffer and his development as an adult, as a theologian, as someone who had to examine all of the pet preconceptions of his life, you will recognize yourself struggling with the things that we have to in our lives. Finally, I want to conclude in my examples with a man that I'm sure many of you have not heard of, but he's an interesting character, Richard Rubinstein. Richard was, and I don't know what's happened to him because I haven't kept up with his career, he was a professor at Florida State University, a professor of psychology. He had been trained as a rabbi, and he fervently was believed in his Judaism and practiced as a Jew until somewhere in the 50s or 60s, he and his development came to the conclusion that he could no longer believe in God. And part of this was due to the loss of some of his family members at Auschwitz, and the final straw, shall we say, was the death of one of his children from some disease. Because of this, because of the idea, like Bonhoeffer, that God controlled our destinies, he could no longer square the fact that things happen in life that did not seem part of a providential wisdom. And so he had to reject the theism that he had been brought up with. He wrote a book in the late 60s, early 70s called My Brother Paul. And what he did was he, with this aha experience that he had, he could draw parallels with his life, and guess who? St. Paul, Saul of Tarsus. And you'll think, oh, wow, I got to read that book. He did not agree with where Paul ended up, with his Christianity, his belief in Jesus Christ as Savior, but he did understand what Paul went through to get there. And it was more than just falling off a horse on the Damascus Road. What Paul went through was to see that his Pharisaic upbringing, his belief in following the law, every jot and tittle, doing this and doing that to be pleasing with God, was no longer going to do. And Paul had a moment of transformation and had to completely reject much of what he had been told as a youth and become a totally new person, embracing Jesus Christ as the author of that new being. And that's the piece that Rubinstein saw as the connection between himself and Saul of Tarsus. And he begins to say that we don't like those experiences. We want to keep them far away. We want to maintain control of our lives. And yet, the path to adulthood and full maturity is to, if not welcome them, is to realize that there's a foul ball out there. There is an experience that will utterly shatter you if you let it, but it has all the makings of making you a new person. Each of these individuals moves beyond the comfortable vision of God that they were raised with, beyond the sentimentality of the Christmas stories as we often are used to find the full flower of the message, to encounter the world and encounter life at the place where we have to often make costly decisions and consequential acts. And I think today, when we look at our world and we move well beyond Janis Jackson's breasts in terms of having the media make us anesthetized to what's happening in the world, we need to find the ways that we can creatively interact with the world, like, ironically, Charlton Heston did in the movie The Ten Commandments, to interact with the world and have the profound effect on the world that the character of Moses did. But also to realize that we'll be called to do things that in our wildest imagination we would never have believed we could do. And that has happened in my life, and I believe that it's happening in your life if you have the lenses to behold it. I want to close with a final example. Since I'm a Presbyterian, I just have to use the scriptures. And I want to close not with Moses, because Charlton Heston certainly represents him well, except strangely, I don't think Heston has a clue about who Moses was, especially as he gets older. I don't get it. That has got to be the ultimate irony. I want to close with a character that I think is overlooked often, Jonah. Oh, and by the way, there's no whale. And in Genesis, there is no apple. And, oh, here's the finishing thing. Nowhere in the Bible does it say it is more blessed to give than receive. It kind of implies that at places, but it doesn't say that. Aren't you glad I'm here today? What do I do with my water? Okay, the prophet Jonah. The best part is that he is an ultranationalist, and he is chafing at the fact that the Assyrians have conquered his kingdom, the people of Israel carried them off into captivity. And so the foul ball for Jonah is what? The word of the Lord comes to Jonah and says, go to Nineveh, which is the capital of the Assyrian Empire, and there I want you to preach And I want you to convert this great people, several hundred thousand. And I want you to change them from the ways they're going to the ways that I direct them. Well, Jonah didn't want to do that. And that's where the whale, the fish comes in. He goes the opposite direction. And we know what happens. He gets tossed overboard. He is in the fish for 3 days. He is regurgitated onto dry land. Now, that must have been an experience. Talk about a... When someone says, are you reborn? You can say, no, but I've been regurgitated. Boy, I bet he was the social life of the party. Hebrews had a lot of fun with their scriptures. Well, he decides, I guess I don't want to go through that again. So he goes to Nineveh, and he preaches, and he hates the preaching, and he doesn't want it to work, and he doesn't want them to repent, because he knows what God will do. God will rain down fire and brimstone, you know, just like Cotton Mather would love. Oh, that's great. Oh, yes, I want to see it. I want to see them incinerated. And you know what? The greatest successful preaching event of all time was by whom? Jonah. It worked. They listened. They changed. And what does Jonah do? He feels sorry for himself. He sulks. He wants to die. He wants God to feel sorry for him. God causes a plant to grow over him. And finally, Jonah says, why did you save those people? Because they're basically human beings that I created. There are 120,000 of them. And the last lines of Jonah, which is the kicker, and also much cattle. Cattle! Jackalopes! Well, the book of Jonah is a tremendous antidote to the hyper-nationalism and exclusivism of ancient Israel at that time. I am shocked that the rabbis included it in the canon. But they knew they needed to include it in there, because that's exactly where we get once in a while. We get smug, we get self-righteous, we are content with where we've been and not where we're going. And those are the kind of people that God likes to work with. And Jonah is the example par excellence. So I want you to think about what it is that is moving in your life, that is creating you still. God's not done with you. Light's not done with you. How it is you're supposed to shed the skin of the old and embrace the new, knowing what it is you're supposed to leave behind, those old pet preconceptions, and embrace the new being, and follow that long train of people who have done that, who hopefully in our country right now will, in the midst of the darkness and the despair and the controversy, will bring us to a new place where it will be sunrise and not sunset. Amen.